Gaza, the symbol of resistance. This is the title of the conference held in Tehran. Attended by Iranian officials and members of Palestinian resistance groups, the event seeks to shed light on Palestinian suffering under more than 7 decades of Israeli occupation, with Gaza bearing the title of an icon for the struggle for freedom.
Gaza, the 360 square kilometer, besieged over 17 years maybe, and with this dire situation, the people over there were managed to steadfast, to confront the continuous aggressions and offensive from the Israeli forces against our civilians, against our common people in Gaza.
The event is held on the anniversary of the 22-day resistance in the Gaza Strip in late 2008 and early 2009, where Palestinians resisted Israel's military offensive.
Today was the day that in Iran we remember the resistance of the Palestinian people in Gaza district after the invasion of the Israeli troops in 2008. On that year, the Israeli troops invaded oppressed people of the Palestinian in Gaza district. And in Iran, every year we remember that.
This year's edition of the annual conference seeks to recognize late Iranian General Qasem Soleimani's role in strengthening the resistance axis in Palestine.
When we talk about freedom, when we talk about resistance, when we talk about Palestine, you cannot miss the name of Shahid Soleimani. Shahid Soleimani is a big icon for us in Palestine and resistance movement to defend our own legitimate right. Shahid Soleimani was a big brother to us.
General Soleimani was killed along with his fellow comrades in January 2020 near Baghdad International Airport in a drone strike launched by the U.S. The Iranian military commander spearheaded major operations in Syria and Iraq that led to the defeat of Daesh and recapturing of key areas from the terror group.
People here say General Soleimani was a key element in the resistance front, who had plans to liberate Palestine from the Israeli occupation. They say this was a major reason why the U.S. assassinated him. Yusuf Jalali, Tehran.
Former EU lawmaker Pierre Antonio Panzeri was among those arrested by Belgian police last month as part of a probe into a cash-for-favour scheme allegedly involving Qatar and Morocco. He has just signed a deal with prosecutors to name names in return for a reduced sentence. On Tuesday, during a debate in the European Parliament on the scandal, the EU itself was accused of corruptly targeting some of its own member states.
Nota bene.
No peace without justice. Whose secretary has been arrested for corruption? This organization was financed by the EU, France and Germany. What a coincidence, because this very organization focused on attacking Poland.
Belgian police have recovered more than €1.5 million in cash following dozens of raids. So far, the scandal mainly involves members of the S&D political grouping in the European Parliament.
Since the accusations emerged in December, we in the Socialists and Democrats group have been working intensively to try and implement reforms to combat corruption. We have to ensure accountability, transparency and integrity.
Sitting Greek MEP Eva Kaili is among four currently behind bars awaiting trial. Lawmakers are demanding that an EU-wide ethics body is established. Aside from the Parliament scandal, each year millions of euro go unaccounted for from the EU budget. This as ordinary citizens struggle to make ends meet.
It's a serious source of concern, and we also see that there is very little progress made on poverty and social exclusion, which remains at very high level in the EU.
Some lawmakers say the EU is showing a great deal of hypocrisy, given that so much is said here about rule of law problems elsewhere. Sources tell us Belgian police will almost certainly be making more arrests in the coming days as part of the European Parliament corruption probe. Jerome Hughes, Brussels.
For over a millennium, Florence, known as the cradle of Renaissance, has been a global icon of beauty, being the third largest tourist destination in Italy after Rome and Venice. Florence, a stunning, vibrant city with a storied and well-preserved history, attracts every year around 60 million tourists from across the world. However, starting from the last decade of the 20th century, its city center has been eyed by big investment groups interested in making profits through the acquisition of local real estate assets. As a result, living costs in the oldest part of Florence went dramatically up, forcing a high number of residents to sell their apartments.
This situation has been going on for a number of years now. Florentines who used to live in the city centre found living costs unsustainable and opted to move to the suburbs. Their former houses have been rented to wealthy tourists, and investment companies have made billions in profits.
Throughout the years, smaller landlords in Florence have been aggressively targeted by large corporate investors. For those investors, housing has turned into a key factor for the management of global capital funds. As a result, the new housing market has led to excessively high rents, widespread displacement, as well as the dismantling of local communities and social bonds. A referendum called Let's Save Florence has been recently launched in the Tuscan city in an attempt to protect the citizens from the real estate bubble and the speculation which have distorted the local housing market. Many hundreds of residents have supported the initiative so far.
It's a shame that Florentines have been forced to leave the city center. It's their city and it's been taken away from them. There have been significant repercussions on Florence's social cohesion, as back in the old days, the city center used to be a meeting point for young and old people. It's really bad for our city's sense of community.
The center of Florence has been placed in the hands of large investment funds, and everything is made to support tourism today. Small shops, typical shops, have been forced to shut down. Just a few thousand Florentines still live in the city center these days. Florence has 360,000 inhabitants today, 200,000 less compared to 20 years ago.
Florence is not the only Italian city where large investment groups have been buying properties in historic areas. Rome, Venice, and Milan have also been the target of corporate landlords. In 2021, in Berlin, Germany, more than 1 million Berliners supported a campaign to expropriate companies holding 3,000 or more apartments. Italian cities should maybe resort to a similar measure to try to keep local residents in the city center. Max Civili, Florence.
We attended a press conference held by Yemen's Ministry of Health in Sana'a, where it was declared that the Saudi-imposed blockade is causing a national health crisis by preventing entry of medicines and equipment for kidney failure patients. In the absence of dialysis treatment, approximately 5,000 patients on dialysis are at risk of dying, according to the health ministry.
The Saudi-led coalition targeted the health and medical sector from the very beginning of the war by directly destroying medical facilities, centers, hospitals, and medicine warehouses, and by imposing a blockade on every aspect of life through this siege that is being backed by America in order to control the country's health system.
Khalid Ahmed is one of the patients on dialysis, who is currently getting treatment at Athoda Hospital. He said the lack of supplies has prevented him and other patients from receiving the required number of dialysis treatments per week.
We cannot eat much because we are only receiving 2 dialysis treatments a week instead of the required 3 treatments. As a result, we can only eat a bare minimum food.
But getting the required 3 treatments per week for Gayed and the other 5,000 patients like him is a near impossible task these days. This mixed solution, which is used to operate the dialysis machine, is in very short supply. There's only enough for 2 more weeks.
It's gotten so bad that we have to close down this section simply because we do not have enough supplies to run all of the dialysis machines. If we opened this section, we would have no more supplies to treat patients. We've had to make emergency requests to other dialysis clinics to provide us with such equipment. By the end of January, we will be forced to close down because we'll have no more supplies to operate.
Unless the kidney disease center at Athoda Hospital is supplied with dialysis filters and the solution needed to operate dialysis machines, they will be forced to shut down by the end of January. If that happens, the lives of approximately 5,000 patients will be at risk. The Yemeni army has repeatedly warned that if the Saudi-imposed blockade is not lifted, it would be forced to take military action. The siege must be ended so that much-needed medicine and other essential supplies can enter the country. Yusuf Maudi, Sana'a.
We are with you. What about you? IRIB English Radio. Please log on to our website, www.parstoday.com/en.
In the limelight.
Britain's Conservative government is introducing stricter laws for public demonstrations in Britain. Also, Prime Minister Rishi Sunak, under pressure from his ruling Conservative Party, has presented a controversial anti-strike bill, which makes it difficult for unions to plan and hold strikes. We take a look at some of the world media's coverage of this issue. Please stay with us. British News have had The Guardian has covered this story and tells us more. Prime Minister Rishi Sunak's government has proposed an amendment to the anti-protest bill, asking lawmakers to give more powers to the police to clamp down on protest rallies in fear of more strike and demonstrations over the cost of living crisis. Through an amendment tabled to the public order bill, the British government is set to announce a series of security measures to enable police to deal with protests before they even happen, thus tightening the government's grip and forcing a crackdown and preventing dissent from growing before it is a disruption to public order. By broadening the legal definition of serious disruption in the British Public Order Bill, Number 10 Downing Street wants to provide British police with a pretext to crack down on protests amid the worsening economic conditions of the country. Despite the increased powers, Rishi Sunak claimed, UK police chiefs had complained to him that there were problems due to ambiguity in the law about the definition of serious disruption, which was creating issues for them. Rishi Sunak claimed in a statement late on Sunday, 15th of January, "The right to protest is a fundamental principle of our democracy, but this is not absolute. A balance must be struck between the rights of individuals and the rights of the hard-working majority who go about their day-to-day business. Britain's National Police Chiefs Council Lead for Public Order and Public Safety, Chief Constable BJ Harrington, said, "We welcome the constructive conversations with government over more clearly defining serious disruption. This will support police officers in confidently and quickly taking action and making arrests where appropriate." Depicting the nationwide protests as criminal activities, Police Chief Constable BJ Harrington claimed that policing is not anti-protest, but there is a difference between protest and criminal activism. "And we're committed to responding quickly and effectively to activists who deliberately disrupt people's lives through dangerous, reckless, and criminal acts." The British government's move to stop protests following a series of demonstrations, mostly by activists who had adopted more effective ways to prompt the UK government to do more about climate change. Meanwhile, the Conservatives are also pushing for new anti-strike legislation, forcing the staff to maintain a basic level of service during strike time or face dismissal. In the past few months, Britain has been grappling with its biggest wave of strikes for decades, with airport baggage handlers, border staff, driving instructors, bus drivers, postal workers, and NHS staff all walking off their jobs to demand higher pay. The Financial Times has also covered this story and tells us more. Britain's Labour Party has slammed the government's new plan to enact legislation aimed at curbing strikes, saying the controversial move trashes civil liberties. The Labour Party's deputy leader, Angela Rayner, said many MPs from the ruling Conservative Party with this bill are burning freedoms for which we fought for centuries. The proposed legislation also angered trade unions that say it would have a chilling effect on workers' willingness to exercise their right to strike. Also on Monday, thousands of demonstrators gathered outside the gates of No. 10 Downing Street to protest against the legislation, carrying signs such as "The right to strike is the right to hope" and "Strike to win." Protesters say the ability to strike allows workers to affirm their rights and negotiate for fair treatment and compensation in the workplace. A protester said during her speech on stage, "If this government was reasonable and negotiating with us, there would be a different matter. But to not negotiate with us and to deny our right to strike, it means you're treating us like slaves with no right to object to our working conditions." The government put forward new legislation in Parliament that will give police officers more powers to crack down and mandate minimum service levels during strikes. On Monday, 16th of January, MPs voted in favour of the legislation by 309 votes in favour, 249 votes against, a majority of 60. Turkey's Anadolu news agency has also covered the same story. Britain's business secretary Grant Shapps challenged opposition parties in a recent parliamentary debate on plans by the government to impose restrictions on industrial action in certain sectors, claiming it supports the right to strike but also wants to take into account the interests of the British public. Grant Shapps said that while the bill is being discussed and passed in the House of Commons, the government will consult on what a minimum level of service should look like in fire and rescue, ambulance service and railways. He said members of the opposition who object to minimum safety levels, well, they need to explain to their constituents why it is that if you have a heart attack, a stroke or life-threatening illness on a strike day, there are no minimum safety standards in place. The deputy leader of the Labour Party, Angela Rayner, told the House of Commons about a person who waited more than an hour for an ambulance and in the meantime died. And that was not on a strike day. She said, "That is because of the disastrous chaos we have in the system under this Conservative government." Angela Rayner asked if Grant Shapps would admit that the government considered banning some key workers from joining unions. She asked the business secretary how sacking key workers won't make services worse. According to Rayner, the legislation is a distraction method used by the government for the problems it has created in the first place. The deputy leader of the Labour Party openly named ministers who also disapprove of the bill, Education Secretary Gillian Keegan and Transport Secretary Mark Harper. Also, the Scottish Nationalist Party spokesman Alan Brown slammed the new bill, saying it's part of a right-wing culture war which sinks. Alan Brown agreed with Labour's stance and blamed the ruling Conservative Party for tanking the economy and charged the government with forcing ordinary people to pay for their mistakes. Alan Brown said, "It has not been easy in Scotland either, but the government there has committed to fair negotiations with striking workers." Labour MP Sam Tarry said Britain is one of the most restricted and anti-worker countries in the world. Sam Tarry said the government is responsible for the failed talks with the unions, and he believes the strikes could end in multiple sectors had the government wanted. Paul Nowak, the General Secretary of the Trades Union Congress, TUC, said if the legislation becomes law, it will prolong disputes and poison industrial relations in Britain, leading to even more strikes.
Now from Ontario, Canada.
Now back to our story.
What is it in there?
We will be talking about this.
Let me bring in Leo Sazdi. He's a professor of international.
The Spotlight.
Hello and welcome to Spotlight. NATO and defense leaders from about 50 countries meet at the United States Ramstein Air Base in Germany. This is the latest arms pledging conference by Western states to discuss sending more weapons to Ukraine, including modern battle tanks. Russia, however, once again has said that these weapons change nothing on the ground but will only prolong the war. On Thursday, Foreign Minister Lavrov said that Moscow will sober up the EU and NATO, who seek to weaken and defeat Russia. While former Russian President Medvedev warned NATO that a defeat for Russia in Ukraine could trigger a nuclear war. We're going to discuss the latest developments regarding the war in Ukraine in tonight's Spotlight program with our guests. Director of Global Studies at Wayne State University, Mr. Saeed Khan, joining us from Detroit. Also, we have Andrei Dobryansky, Chair of UN Affairs, the Ukrainian World Congress, is with us from New York.
This is The Spotlight. The Spotlight takes an in-depth look at the headlines, featuring interviews with well-known guests from diverse backgrounds to get to the bottom of the story. You can listen to The Spotlight every day on IRIB English Radio.
Well, gentlemen, welcome to the program. Let's start off with Mr. Saad Khan in Detroit. The U.S. And Finland, they've already announced new military aid for Ukraine, despite Russian warnings that more weapons will mean more war. Give us your perspective on the recent developments, please.
Well, I don't know if it necessarily means more war. I think Russia has an awful lot to do with deciding if there is the minimization and reduction of the war. Given the asymmetric nature of the balance of power between Russia and the Ukraine, one would think that some kind of aid that is being provided to Ukraine would appear to be a goal toward more equity. In the case of Finland, I can understand why they would be interested in providing aid. They share a very long border with Russia. And of course, they are concerned of Russia's past rhetoric when it comes to what and how they view their neighbor to the north, Finland, when it comes to matters of potential encroachment. For the United States, with a pledge of an additional $2.5 billion in weapons, this seems to be tied in large part to also allaying concerns by the European Union that the United States is not pulling its so-called fair share in providing assistance. After all, the U.S. is very good with its rhetoric in its support when it comes to Ukraine, but hasn't necessarily been, in the estimation of the EU, putting its money where its mouth is. So this will certainly be in furtherance of that.
Mr. Dobryansky, Russia has accused Western countries of pursuing, quote, destructive policies by supplying Kiev with weapons and training and not seeking to find a solution to end the conflict. The Russian president has said that Western countries are exploiting Ukraine and using its people as, quote, cannon fodder. Just recently, the Russian foreign minister said that Washington has subjugated Europe in order to wage war against Moscow. Walk us through these comments and whether you agree with them or not.
I don't think anybody in the world really agrees with those comments. We see that in resolution after resolution in international bodies, whether that's the United Nations, the OSCE, and numerous international conventions that Russia is a party to. So what is happening here, and while I agree with most of the statements of my colleague, I will say that Russia has very much shown itself to be a paper tiger. So in terms of calling it an evening out of the military parties, it's quite clear that Russia has been unable to do any more than it has projected onto Ukraine to achieve victory there. What we've seen most recently in the last week has been private military contractors subsidized by prisoners being sent into Ukraine to achieve Pyrrhic victories, which really don't take hold of any population centers or anything like that. So it's quite clear that what's happening with the supply of weapons from Ukraine's allies, and let's just remind everybody that there aren't any allies that Russia can turn to apart from North Korea, perhaps Iran and Syria. Apart from that, they're not really achieving any weapons technology from anywhere else. So Ukraine has the benefit of working alongside its longstanding Western partners. And it's not just Finland, it's not just the United States, but in the last 7 days, and I was just in Ukraine 7 days ago, we've had weapon pledges in addition to what's been before from all three Baltic countries, from Poland again, and many other countries. So when we're talking about Europe needing to step up to the plate, it is frankly those large financial centers of France and Germany that the United States would like to see more come out of.
Saad Khan, do you agree with our guests in New York?
I think in most part, yes. I think, though, that one has to go ahead and consider the fact that Russia, though, still is a nuclear power. And I know that many would go ahead and argue that Russia wouldn't dare to go ahead and use some kind of nuclear weaponry. But there are tactical weapons. There are tactical nuclear weapons. And at this point, we simply don't know how Russia would respond. There is both a certain level of erratic behavior on the part of President Putin, and at the same time, as we approach the one-year anniversary, clearly it has moved beyond the 3 days that Putin had promised his own people and the rest of the world would be the campaign within Ukraine. Ukraine has shown remarkable resolve and resilience to defy the act of aggression. But at the same time, we have to also recognize, as my colleague said, that while Russia may appear to be a paper tiger, it is exactly when a tiger is cornered that it sometimes becomes more dangerous. So, again, we really have to wait and see how Russia is going to respond to these kinds of measures that are now being taken.
All right, Saeed Khan, I'm going to stay with you. NATO members have met to discuss whether to send modern battle tanks to Kiev. In recent days, German officials said they won't send their modern Leopard tanks to Ukraine and would not allow any other country with German-made tanks to send them either. Also, according to reports, Berlin will supply its tanks only if the U.S. sends its Abrams tanks first. Why this hesitation from Germany and from the U.S. even, for that matter?
I would say for two reasons. One is that it shows a certain attitude by Western countries that no one really wants to take the physical lead on this matter. And so Berlin is looking to Washington. Washington is looking to Germany. And while this happens, Ukraine's needs go unanswered and unaddressed. There's also, I think, one thing that people have not considered when it comes to the kind of weaponry that's involved. I mean, the Abrams tank is a highly complex piece of machinery. The training learning curve will be very steep. The idea of an Abrams tank being lost in Ukraine and perhaps then being seized by Russia is a matter of concern for the Pentagon. Given the kind of technology that it has, falling into the wrong hands and essentially being reverse engineered would be a problem. And then there's also the weather. The idea then of both the Leopard tank from Germany as well as the Abrams tank, both very sophisticated weapons, coming into the Ukraine with a timetable of the spring means that the ground and the terrain will have started to soften. Right now it is winter time. The ground becomes a little bit more solid. But imagine these tanks having to maneuver in March or April when there are rains and when it becomes rather muddy. So I think there's probably a lot of diffidence on the part of the United States as well as Germany to have this investment placed on the ground in Ukraine and what that will necessarily mean for their weaponry to be effective in the field.
Mr. Dobryansky in New York, same question to you. Talk to us about this split in NATO regarding providing the modern tanks to Ukraine.
Well, we do have the pledge by the United Kingdom first and foremost. With regards to Germany, there are many different variations of what exactly will happen with them. I always look back to the beginning of this conflict and the fact that Patriots were off the table and now Patriots are being pledged by various countries, not just the United States. With the German tanks, you have about 2,000 of them spread out across various NATO allies. Less than half of those are of the newest technology, the ones that we would not want as a Western country to fall into Russian hands. So we're talking about the older variants of them, of which Ukraine really would estimate need maybe 100 at most, which is why they're looking at that technology, because it will be closer than getting an Abrams. As opposed to the Abrams, let me just add one more thing, that both Secretary Lloyd Austin and the chairman of the Joint Chiefs made it clear that in their estimation, after talking with the German ministry, that whatever promise the United States would make would not affect the decision of Germany. So that should be kind of bifurcated at this point. But let's concentrate on what has been promised by the United States, which are these Bradley fighting vehicles, which currently we have already begun training Ukrainian soldiers on. The Bradley fighting vehicle is as effective, in my estimation, as an Abrams for the kind of fighting that will be happening in Ukraine. It is a treaded vehicle, and it can keep up at the same speed as the highly effective Abrams tank. However, it offers the mobilization of the troops, because not only do you have those powerful TOW missiles that can destroy a tank and the powerful machine gun, which has not only decimated Soviet technologies like the T-72s in foreign conflicts in Afghanistan, but actually in the first Desert Storm War, those Bradley fighting vehicles accounted for more destroyed tanks than the Abrams tanks. So this is a very significant fighting vehicle. And then you'll have the non-treaded variation, the Stryker, which is on wheels, that's even faster than the Bradley vehicle. And these are methods for the Ukraine forces to fire while moving their forces at the same time, because both of those vehicles can accommodate 6 to 8 infantrymen within them.
I'm going to stay with you, Mr. Dobryansky. Russia has time and again said countries supplying weapons to Ukraine and training its soldiers were, in fact, parties to the conflict. Now, the question is, will this support result in this conflict spilling over into other regions and possibly turning into something bigger?
I think that's the message that Ukraine has had and the West has had, as the NATO alliance and EU, from the very beginning of Putin's presidency. We know already that legacy troops never left territories after the dissolvement of the Soviet Union, but we've had the war in Georgia. We've had additional troops sent into Nagorno-Karabakh. We've had, obviously, this invasion of Ukraine. I think the focus on containing Russia, as has been mentioned by numerous defense secretaries and foreign ministers since the beginning of this full-fledged conflict in Ukraine, is exactly what needs to be talked about. We need to contain Russia so it doesn't spill out. I was just with a senator of the United States last night, and he made that point very clearly. We do not want this conflict to spill to a NATO territory, which is why it needs to be stopped. It should have been stopped in Georgia. It should have been stopped in other areas. But if we don't stop it in Ukraine, it will absolutely continue on to NATO countries.
This is The Spotlight. The Spotlight takes an in-depth look at the headlines, featuring interviews with well-known guests from diverse backgrounds to get to the bottom of the story. You can listen to The Spotlight every day on IRIB English Radio.
And Saidkhan, I want to get your perspective on that as well. The risks of this military support resulting in the conflict spilling over into other regions and possibly turning into something bigger. Also, on the previous question that we just talked to our guests in New York about the issue of sending these modern battle tanks to Ukraine, Russia said that the modern tanks actually will change nothing on the ground. Give us your perspective on both those issues.
Well, first of all, I don't think that that Russia really then understands modern warfare. And perhaps the reason why they're seemingly being so dismissive of it is because they know full well that, in fact, it will change the balance of power on the ground. Having heavy artillery is very effective, both against artillery that Russia is sending in, and of course also against any kind of infantry force. The second point about that is that, remember, tanks, whether it is the Bradley or whatever might else be pledged, are still defensive weapons. And so here we find then weaponry that is being used within Ukraine to try to repel an aggressive and encroaching force, i.e. Russia. They are not an offensive weapon. If Russia wants to then go ahead and engage in this rhetoric, then perhaps we need to ask the question, what about Turkey, which supplies Ukraine with drones? Is Russia going to take any kind of hostile posture toward Ankara? Is it then fair game for the United States and the West to take posture against countries like India and China that are breaching the sanctions going on? We can go ahead and play this game of concentric circles and ask the question about whether this is going to metastasize and escalate. But I think that my colleague in New York is absolutely right. What we really are focusing on here is to prevent any kind of spillover into a NATO country and to then exercise a very long-standing policy of containment.
All right, let's rewind. I'm going to stay with Mr. Saidkhan of Detroit. Let's rewind to a past statement by U.S. Secretary of Defense Lloyd Austin, who said one of Washington's goals in Ukraine is to see a weakened Russia. Why does Washington want a weakened Russia?
Well, I think we have to take a look at the context of this. While there are those certainly in Moscow which see this as a strategic statement, i.e. that Washington wants to see an enfeebled Russia moving forward in a geopolitical scenario, I think we can go ahead and give Secretary Austin the benefit of the doubt that he is seeking to see a weakened Russia with its operations in the Ukraine. And in this kind of conflict, of course, it is perfectly reasonable to then expect and desire Russia becoming weakened when it has invaded another sovereign state, and to see it weakened to the point where it either reevaluates its decision-making or preferably simply retreats altogether.
And same question to you, Mr. Dobryansky, the comments by the U.S. Defense Secretary Lloyd Austin about the United States actually wanting to see a weakened Russia.
Wanting to see a Russia that would not have the capacity to do the same thing to other countries as it's doing to Ukraine, which the entire world wants to see. This has, again, been voted on in resolution after resolution at the General Assembly of the United Nations. Nobody wants to see a country that has already invaded its neighboring territories, given the ability to continue on and do more. This is the exact international framework that we've worked towards to prevent this kind of incursion onto neighboring territories. And Russia has thumbed its nose since the very beginning of this conflict. And I think the entire world, not just the United States, not just Secretary Austin, would like to see a Russia that is not in a capacity to invade other countries. It's not good for the countries that are being invaded, not good for the people who are victims of war crimes after war crimes by Russian soldiers. It simply should not happen.
Right now, on the issue of Russia and Ukraine, let's talk about Europe here. During a recent debate at the European Parliament, dissenting views were expressed regarding EU's foreign policy. Some legislators expressed support for Ukraine. Others warned that the bloc's own citizens should not be neglected in the process. Are European citizens on board with enduring these hardships?
Well, I mean, the European Parliament is, of course, a deliberative body. It's going to have quite a bit of diversity. And while on the one hand, the European Union is going to try to speak with one voice, there are the complexities of issues on a national level. One being, of course, the economics with high inflation rate and the needs of many people. I mean, in many of these countries, as you've seen, even in France recently, there are protests regarding President Macron's decision to up the retirement age. That is then political fodder for those who are saying that why be concerned with a war that doesn't seem to necessarily impact us directly when there seems to be an urgent need for domestic issues to be addressed. Other countries, which either are more geographically proximate to the issue or militarily so, are going to have a different posture altogether. And then, of course, there's energy needs, which Russia certainly does supply to a good amount of the European Union. So dissenting opinions are hardly going to be seen as a surprise when it comes to the Ukraine and what kind of intervention needs to be done.
Mr. Dobryansky, massive inflation, a cost of living crisis, energy crisis. Some countries like the UK, they're having its citizens face unprecedented energy bills, with many European countries facing energy rationing. What is the cost of this conflict and its repercussions for Europe as opposed to the U.S.?
I think we're talking specifically about fossil fuel prices here, and I think the final cost will be the eventual migration away from our dependency on fossil fuels. It's been a point of contention in Germany for years now, the Russian pipeline and the fact that they were wedded to this kind of fossil fuel economy. We've seen the amounts of renewables that have just gone up for decade after decade. And in the end, Russia will not be the holder of all energy costs for the rest of Europe, and it will be renewables. And it'll be what's better for the entire planet as we move away from Russia basically having everybody dependent on them.
So what's the end game here for Europe? What's the winning scenario looking like for Europe?
The winning scenario is the fact that the entire world will be in a better place if Russia will not be invading other countries and if Europe moves away from fossil fuels.
All right, Mr. Saidkhan, would you like to add anything to that?
I concur. I think that a win for the for Europe would be to see Russia withdraw, for there to be some kind of, at the very least, detente between Ukraine and Russia. I think if it was a matter of an ideal situation, it would be that Russia also withdraws from territory that it has occupied and has claimed as being over its sovereignty, whether in the east of Ukraine or what really got this going the Crimean Peninsula. That, I think, is going to be a much more elusive goal. I think just the idea of a détente might be enough to satisfy Europe to claim a victory.
All right, gentlemen, that's all the time we have for the show. Sagkhon, Director of Global Studies at Wayne State University, joining us from Detroit. Andrei Dobryansky, Chair of UN Affairs at Ukrainian World Congress, joining us from New York. Thank you for your comments here on tonight's Spotlight. And special thanks to you, our guests, for staying with us on tonight's show. It's good night for now.
The Limelight.
A new poll shows that half of citizens in nine EU nations want a quick end to Ukraine-Russia crisis. In this regard, we have taken a look at world media websites for further details. Stay tuned for more. RT reported in this regard, roughly half of the people in nine EU nations favor a swift end to the armed conflict in Ukraine, even if it means Kiev would have to relinquish its claims on some of its former territory. A new opinion poll has shown. The survey was conducted in Austria, France, Germany, Greece, Italy, the Netherlands, Poland, Portugal, and Spain. The results were reported recently by Euroscopia, an alliance of polling agencies based in those countries. Some 48% of all respondents said they favored a quick resolution to the conflict, even if it meant Ukraine had to lose land to achieve that goal. Only 32% opposed the idea of Kiev making sacrifices. Ukrainian officials pledged to fight until their forces seize control of all the territory the country considers its own, and EU leaders have vowed to help as long as it takes. The EU public's skepticism was particularly profound in Austria and Germany, where 64% and 60% of those surveyed, respectively, favored a shortcut to peace. Euroscopia noted that this perspective clashed with the official stance of the German government, which has been among the most generous supporters in the EU in terms of military aid to Kiev. Respondents in the Netherlands, 27%, and Poland, 28%, were the least supportive of making compromises to achieve peace, the poll indicated. A majority of people in nine EU nations, that is 56%, want to continue shipping arms to Ukraine, but there was a dissenting minority. In Greece and Italy, 60% and 50% of survey participants opposed the military assistance to Ukraine, while 38% in each country said they approved of it. Greeks and Italians are also among the least supportive of the sanctions imposed by the EU on Russia, according to the poll, while over 51% of all people polled favored the restrictions. The share of Greeks and Italians backing the policy was just 29% and 38% respectively. In Austria, 38% of respondents approved the sanctions. The website of Euractiv also noted 50% of surveyed Spaniards think that the Russia-Ukraine conflict should end as soon as possible, even if this means Ukrainians would have to sacrifice some territory and make concessions to Moscow, a new pan-European survey shows. The study was carried out by the European Opinion Polling Network in 9 EU countries, including Portugal, Austria, the Netherlands, Poland, Spain, France, Germany, Italy, and Greece. Euractiv's partner EFE reports. In Spain, the study was carried out by Sigma Das at the end of December based on interviews with 1,000 people. The study revealed that voters of the left-wing ruling coalition parties are the ones most in favor of an early end to the crisis, even if it means territorial concessions. Both 61% of left-wing Unidas Podemos voters and 55% of center-left PSOE voters put peace before a complete victory for Ukraine with the help of the Western allies. About 46% of center-right Partido Popular voters agree, as do 45% of far-right Vox voters and 44% of central-liberal citizens voters. However, 38% of PP voters disagree, as do 36% of Vox voters and 41% of CS voters. With regard to Madrid's military support for the Ukrainians, 61% of Spaniards are in favor, an issue which significantly divides voters of different political camps. PSOE voters and PP voters agree with more than 60%, while more than half of Unidas Podemos voters reject any extension of Spanish military support to Kiev. Similarly, Unidas Podemos voters stand out from the rest when asked whether the EU should buy gas from Russia again if the conflict in Ukraine ends with an agreement which is rejected by one of every two Spaniards. However, 41.4% of Unidas Podemos voters would negotiate with Russian President Vladimir Putin, but among PSOV voters, only 32% would consider doing so. Euroscopia survey also revealed that important differences are emerging among Europeans regarding managing the war in Ukraine. In all the EU countries surveyed, 48% are in favor of a quick end to military help to Kiev. Austria with 64% support for a quick end of the crisis, and Germany with 60% are the member states with the highest support for that option.